sure if there are any provisions beyond this point.
Will we be alive a week from now?
Thought the consul. He said nothing. They ferried the gear to the station in two trips. Wind whistled through the open windows and shattered domes of the dark buildings. On the second trip, the consul carried one end of Mastine's Mobius cube, while Lennar Hoyt puffed and panted under the other end.
"Why are we taking the Urk thing with us?"
gasped Hoyt, as they reached the base of the metal stairway leading to the station. Rust streaked and spotted the platform like orange lichen.
"I don't know,"
said the consul, gasping for breath himself. From the terminal platform, they could see far out over the sea of grass. The wind wagon set where they had left it, sails reefed, a dark and lifeless thing. Snow squalls moved across the prairie and gave the illusion of whitecaps on the numberless stalks of high grass.
"Get the material aboard,"
called Kassad.
"I'll see if the running gear can be reset from the operator's cabin up there."
"Isn't it automatic?"
asked Martin Silenus, his small head almost lost in thick furs.
"Like the wind wagon?"
"I don't think so. Go on. I'll see if I can get it started up."
"What if it leaves without you?"
called Lamia at the colonel's retreating back.
"It won't."
The interior of the tram car was cold and bare, except for metal benches in the forward compartment, and a dozen rough bunks in the smaller rear area. The car was big, at least 8 meters long by 5 wide. The rear compartment was partitioned from the front cabin by a thin metal bulkhead with an opening but no door. A small commode took up a closet-sized corner of this aft compartment. Windows rising from waist height to the roof line lined the forward compartment. The pilgrims heaped their luggage in the center of the wide floor and stomped around, waved their arms, or otherwise worked to stay warm. Martin Silenus lay full length on one of the benches, with only his feet and the top of his head emerging from fur.
"I forgot. How the fuck do you turn on the heat in this thing?"
The consul glanced at the dark lighting panels.
"It's electrical. It'll come on when the colonel gets us moving."
"If the colonel gets us moving,"
said Silenus. Saul Weintraub had changed Rachel's diaper. Now he bundled her up again, in an infant's therm suit, and rocked her in his arms.
"Obviously I've never been here before. Both of you gentlemen have?"
"Yeah,"
said the poet.
"No,"
said the consul.
"But I've seen pictures of the tramway."
"Kassad said he returned to Keats once this way,"
called Braun Lamia from the outer room.
"I think,"
began Saul Weintraub, and was interrupted by a great grinding of gears and a wild lurch as the long car rocked sickeningly and then swung forward under the suddenly moving cable. Everyone rushed to the window on the platform side. Kassad had thrown his gear aboard before climbing the long ladder to the operator's cabin. Now he appeared in the cabin's doorway, slid down the long ladder, and ran toward the car. The car was already passing beyond the loading area of the platform.
"He isn't going to make it,"
whispered Father Hoyt. Kassad sprinted the last 10 meters with legs that looked impossibly long, a cartoon stick figure of a man. The tram car slid out of the loading notch, swung free of the station. Space opened between the car and the station. It was 8 meters to the rocks below. The platform deck was streaked with ice. Kassad ran full speed ahead, even as the car pulled away.
"Come on!"
screamed Braun Lamia. The others picked up the cry. The consul looked up at sheaths of ice cracking and dropping away from the cable as the tram car moved up and forward. He looked back. There was too much space. Kassad could never make it. Fedmon Kassad was moving at an incredible speed when he reached the edge of the platform. The consul was reminded for the second time of the old Earth Jaguar he had seen in Alussis Zoo. He half expected to see the colonel's feet slip on a patch of ice, the long legs flying out horizontal, the man falling silently to the snowy boulders below. Instead, Kassad seemed to fly for an endless moment, long arms extended, cape flying out behind. He disappeared behind the car. There came a thud, followed by a long minute when no one spoke or moved. They were 40 meters high now, climbing toward the first tower. A second later, Kassad became visible at the corner of the car, pulling himself along a series of icy niches and handholds in the metal. Braun Lamia flung open the cabin door. 10 hands helped pull Kassad inside. "Thank God," said Father Hoyt. The colonel took a deep breath and smiled grimly.
"There was a dead man's break. I had to rig the lever with a sandbag. I didn't want to bring the car back for a second try."
Martin Silenus pointed to the rapidly approaching support tower and the ceiling of clouds just beyond. The cable stretched upward into oblivion.
"I guess we're crossing the mountains now, whether we want to or not."
"How long to make the crossing?" asked Hoyt.
12 hours. A little less, perhaps. Sometimes the operators would stop the cars if the wind rose too high, or the ice got too bad. We won't be stopping on this trip,"
said Kassad.
"Unless the cable's breached somewhere,"
said the poet.
"Or we hit a snag."
"Shut up. Who's interested in heating some dinner?"
"Look," said the consul. They moved to the forward windows. The tram rose 100 meters above the last brown curve of foothills. Kilometers below and behind, they caught a final glimpse of the station, the haunted hovels of Pilgrim's Rest and the motionless wind wagon. Then snow and thick cloud enveloped them. The tram car had no real cooking facilities, but the aft bulkhead offered a cold box and a microwave for reheating. Lamia and Weintraub combined various meats and vegetables from the wind wagon's galley to produce a passable stew. Martin Silenus had brought along wine bottles from both the Benares and the wind wagon, and he chose a Hyperion Burgundy to go with the stew. They were nearly finished with their dinner when the gloom pressing against the windows lightened and then lifted altogether. The consul turned on his bench to see the sun suddenly reappear, filling the tram car with a transcendent golden light. There was a collective sigh from the group. It had seemed that darkness had fallen hours before, but now, as they rose above a sea of clouds from which rose an island chain of mountains, they were treated to a brilliant sunset. Hyperion's sky had deepened from its daytime glaucous glare to the bottomless lapis lazuli of evening, while a red-gold sun ignited cloud towers and great summits of ice and rock. The consul looked around. His fellow pilgrims, who had seemed gray and small in the dim light of half a minute earlier, now glowed in the gold of sunset. Martin Silenus raised his glass.
"That's better, by God."
The consul looked up at their line of travel, the massive cable dwindling to thread-like thinness far ahead, and then to nothing at all. On a summit several kilometers beyond, gold light glinted on the next support tower.
192 pylons,
said Silenus in a sing-song tour guide's bored tones.
"Each pylon is constructed of duralloy and whiskered carbon and stands 83 meters high."
"We must be high,"
said Braun Lamia in a low voice.
"The high point of the 96-kilometer tramcar voyage lies above the summit of Mount Dryden, the fifth highest peak in the Bridal Range, at 9,246 meters.
Droned on Martin Silenus. Colonel Kassad looked around.
"The cabin's pressurized. I felt the changeover some time ago."
"Look."
The sun had been resting on the horizon line of clouds for a long moment. Now it dipped below, seemingly igniting the depths of storm cloud from beneath and casting a panoply of colors along the entire western edge of the world. Snow cornices and glaze ice still glowed along the western side of the peaks, which rose a kilometer or more above the rising tramcar. A few brighter stars appeared in the deepening dome of sky. The consul turned to Braun Lamia.
"Why don't you tell your story now, M. Lamia? We'll want to sleep later, before arriving at the keep."
Lamia sipped the last of her wine.
"Does everyone want to hear it now?"
Heads nodded in the roseate twilight. Martin Silenus shrugged.
"All right."
She set down her empty glass, pulled her feet up on the bench so that her elbows rested on her knees, and began her tale.
The Detective's Tale. The Long Goodbye. I knew the case was going to be special the minute that he walked into my office. He was beautiful. By that, I don't mean effeminate or pretty in the male model HTV star mode, merely beautiful. He was a short man, no taller than I, and I was born and raised in Lussis's 1.3G field. It was apparent in a second that my visitor was not from Lussis. His compact form was well-proportioned by web standards, athletic but thin. His face was a study in purposeful energy. Low brow, sharp cheekbones, compact nose, solid jaw, and a wide mouth that suggested both a sensuous side and a stubborn streak. His eyes were large and hazel-colored. He looked to be in his late 20s standard. Understand, I didn't itemize all this the moment he walked in. My first thought was, is this a client? My second thought was, shit, this guy's beautiful. M. Lamia? Yeah? M. Braun Lamia of Allweb Investigations? Yeah. He looked around as if he didn't quite believe it. I understood the look. My office is on the 23rd level of an old industrial hive in the old digs section of Iron Pig on Lussis. I have three big windows that look out on Service Trench 9, where it's always dark and always drizzling, thanks to a massive filter drip from the hive above. The view is mostly of abandoned automated loading docks and rusted girders. What the hell, it's cheap. And most of my clients call rather than show up in person. "May I sit down?" he asked, evidently satisfied that a bona fide investigatory agency would operate out of such a slum. "Sure," I said, and waved him to a chair. Johnny, he said. He didn't look like a first name type to me. Something about him breathed money. It wasn't his clothes, common enough casuals in black and gray, although the fabric was better than average. It was just a sense that the guy had class. There was something about his accent. I'm good at placing dialects. It helps in this profession. But I couldn't place this guy's home world, much less local region. "How can I help you, Johnny?" I held out the bottle of scotch I had been ready to put away just as he entered. Johnny boy shook his head. Maybe he thought I wanted him to drink from the bottle. Hell, I have more class than that. There are paper cups over by the water cooler. "M. Lamia," he said, the cultivated accent still bugging me by its elusiveness. "I need an investigator." "That's what I do." He paused. Shy. A lot of my clients are hesitant to tell me what the job is. No wonder, since 95% of my work is divorce and domestic stuff. I waited him out. "It's a somewhat sensitive matter," he said at last. "Yeah, Johnny, most of my work falls under that category. I'm bonded with Uniweb, and everything having to do with a client falls under the Privacy Protection Act. Everything is confidential, even the fact that we're talking now, even if you decide not to hire me. That was basic bullshit, since the authorities could get at my files in a moment if they ever wanted to, but I sensed that I had to put this guy at ease somehow. God, he was beautiful. Uh-huh, he said, and glanced around again. He leaned forward. M. Lamia, I would want you to investigate a murder. This got my attention. I'd been reclining with my feet on the desk. Now I sat up and leaned forward. A murder? Are you sure? What about the cops? They aren't involved. That's not possible, I said, with the sinking feeling that I was dealing with a loony rather than a client. It's a crime to conceal a murder from the authorities. What I thought was, are you the murderer, Johnny? He smiled and shook his head. Not in this case. What do you mean? I mean, M. Lamia, that a murder was committed, but that the police, local and hegemony, have neither knowledge of it nor jurisdiction over it. Not possible, I said again. Outside, sparks from an industrial welder's torch cascaded into the trench along with the rusty drizzle. Explain. A murder was committed outside of the web, outside of the protectorate. There were no local authorities. That made sense. Sort of. For the life of me, though, I couldn't figure where he was talking about. Even the outback settlements and colonial worlds have cops. On board some sort of spaceship? Uh-uh. The Interstellar Transit Authority has jurisdiction there. I see, I said. It had been some weeks since I'd had a case. All right, tell me the details. And the conversation will be confidential, even if you do not take the case? Absolutely. And if you do take the case, you will report only to me? Of course. My prospective client hesitated, rubbing his fingers against his chin. His hands were exquisite. All right, he said at last. Start at the beginning, I said. Who was murdered? Johnny sat up straight, an attentive schoolboy. There was no doubting his sincerity. He said, I was. It took 10 minutes to get the story out of him. When he was finished, I no longer thought he was crazy. I was, or I would be if I took the job. Johnny, his real name was a code of digits, letters, and cipher bands longer than my arm, was a cybrid. I'd heard about cybrids, who hasn't? I once accused my first husband of being one. But I never expected to be sitting in the same room with one, or to find it so damned attractive. Johnny was an AI. His consciousness, or ego, or whatever you want to call it, floated somewhere in the megadatasphere datum plane of the Technocore. Like everyone else except maybe the current Senate CEO or the AI's garbage removers, I had no idea where the Technocore was. The AIs had peacefully seceded from human control more than 3 centuries ago, before my time, and while they continued to serve the hegemony as allies by advising the All-Thing, monitoring the dataspheres, occasionally using their predictive abilities to help us avoid major mistakes or natural disasters, the Technocore generally went about its own indecipherable and distinctly non-human business in privacy. Fair enough, it seemed to me. Usually, AIs do business with humans and human machines via the datasphere. They can manufacture an interactive holo if they need to. I remember during the Maui Covenant incorporation, the Technocore ambassadors at the treaty signing looked suspiciously like the old hollow star Tyrone Bathwaite. Cybrids are a whole different matter. Tailored from human genetic stock, they are far more human in appearance and outward behavior than androids are allowed to be. Agreements between the Technocore and the Hegemony allow only a handful of cybrids to be in existence. I looked at Johnny. From an AI's perspective, the beautiful body and intriguing personality sitting across the desk from me must be merely another appendage, a remote, somewhat more complex, but otherwise no more important than any of 10,000 such sensors, manipulators, autonomous units, or other remotes that an AI might use in a day's work. Discarding Johnny probably would create no more concern in an AI than clipping a fingernail would bother me. What a waste, I thought. A cybrid, I said. Yes, licensed. I have a World Web User's visa. Good, I heard myself say. And someone murdered your cybrid, and you want me to find out who? No, said the young man. He had brownish-red curls. Like his accent, the hairstyle eluded me. It seemed archaic somehow, but I had seen it somewhere. It was not merely this body that was murdered. My assailant murdered me. You? Yes. You, as in the, AI itself? Precisely. I didn't get it. AIs can't die. Not as far as anyone in the web knew. I don't get it, I said. Johnny nodded. Unlike a human personality, which can, I believe the consensus is, be destroyed at death, my own consciousness cannot be terminated. There was, however, as a result of the assault, an interruption. Although I possessed, shall we say, duplicate recordings of memories, personality, etc., there was a loss. Some data were destroyed in the attack. In that sense, the assailant committed murder. I see, I lied. I took a breath. What about the AI authorities, if there are such things, or the Hegemony cybercops? Wouldn't they be the ones to go to? For personal reasons, said the attractive young man whom I was trying to see as a cybrid, it is important, even necessary, that I do not consult these sources. I raised an eyebrow. This sounded more like one of my regular clients. I assure you, he said, it is nothing illegal nor unethical, merely embarrassing to me on a level which I cannot explain. I folded my arms across my chest. Look, Johnny, this is a pretty half-assed story. I mean, I only have your word that you're a cybrid. You might be a scam artist for all I know. He looked surprised. I had not thought of that. How would you like me to show you that I am what I say I am? I did not hesitate a second. Transfer a million marks to my checking account in Transweb, I said. Johnny smiled. At the same instant, my phone rang, and the image of a harried man with the Transweb code block floating behind him said, Excuse me, Emlamia, but we wondered with a deposit of this size, if you would be interested in investigating our long-term savings options or our mutual assured market possibilities? Later, I said. The bank manager nodded and vanished. That could have been a simulation, I said. Johnny's smile was pleasant. Yes, but even that would be a satisfactory demonstration, would it not? Not necessarily, he shrugged. Assuming I am what I say I am, will you take the case? Yeah, I sighed. One thing, though, my fee isn't a million marks. I get 500 a day plus expenses. The cybrid nodded. Does that mean you will take the case? I stood up, put on my hat, and pulled an old coat from a rack by the window. I bent over the lower desk drawer, smoothly sliding my father's pistol into a coat pocket. Let's go, I said. Yes, said Johnny. Go where? I want to see where you were murdered. Stereotype has it that someone born on Lussis hates to leave the hive and suffers from instant agoraphobia if we visit anything more open to the elements than a shopping mall. The truth of it is, most of my business comes from and leads to off-world. Skip-tracing deadbeats who use the Farcaster system and a change of identity to try to start over. Finding philandering spouses who think rendezvousing on a different planet will keep them safe from discovery. Tracking down missing kids and absent parents. Still, I was surprised to the point of hesitating a second when we stepped through the Iron Pig Concourse Farcaster onto an empty stone plateau which seemed to stretch to infinity. Except for the bronze rectangle of the Farcaster portal behind us, there was no sign of civilization anywhere. The air smelled like rotten eggs. The sky was a yellow-brown cauldron of sick-looking clouds. The ground around us was gray and scaled and held no visible life, not even lichen. I had no idea how far away the horizon really was, but we felt high, and it looked far, and there was no hint of trees, shrubs, or animal life in the distance either. Where the hell are we? I asked. I had been sure that I knew all of the worlds in the web. Madia, said Johnny, pronouncing it something like Mudya. I never heard of it, I said, putting one hand in my pocket and finding the pearl-handled grip of Dad's automatic. It's not officially in the web yet, said the cybrid. Officially, it's a colony of Parvati, but it's only light minutes from the force base there, and the Farcaster connections have been set up before Mudya joins the Protectorate. I looked at the desolation. The sulfur dioxide stench was making me ill, and I was afraid it was going to ruin my suit. Colonies? Nearby? No, there are several small cities on the other side of the planet. What's the nearest inhabited area? Nanda Devi, a town of about 300 people. It's more than 2,000 kilometers to the south. Then why put a Farcaster portal here? Potential mining sites, said Johnny. He gestured toward the Grey Plateau. Heavy metals. The consortium authorized over 100 Farcaster portals in this hemisphere for easy access once the development began. Okay, I said. It's a good place for a murder. Why'd you come here? I don't know. It was part of the memory section lost. Who'd you come with? I don't know that either. What do you know? The young man put his graceful hands in his pockets. Whoever, whatever, attacked me used a type of weapon known in the Corps as an AIDS II virus. What's that? AIDS II was a human plague disease back long before the Hegira, said Johnny. It disabled the immune system. This virus works the same with an AI. In less than a second, it infiltrates security systems and turns lethal phagocyte programs against the host, against the AI itself, against me. So you couldn't have contracted this virus naturally? Johnny smiled. Impossible. It's comparable to asking a shooting victim if he might not have fallen on the bullets. I shrugged. Look, if you want a datum net or AI expert, you've come to the wrong woman. Other than accessing the sphere like 20 billion other chumps, I know zilch about the ghost world. I used the old term to see if it would get a rise out of him. I know, said Johnny, still equable. That's not what I want you to do. What do you want me to do? Find out who brought me here and killed me, and why. All right. Why do you think this is where the murder took place? Because this is where I regained control of my cybrid when I was reconstituted. You mean your cybrid was incapacitated while the virus destroyed you? Yes. And how long did that last? My death? Almost a minute before my reserve persona could be activated. I laughed. I couldn't help myself. What is amusing, Amlamia? Your concept of death, I said. The hazel eyes looked sad. Perhaps it is amusing to you, but you have no idea what a minute of disconnection means to an element of the technocore. It is eons of time and information, millennia of non-communication. Yeah, I said, able to hold back my own tears without too much effort. So, what did your body, your cybrid, do while you were changing personae tapes or whatever? I presume it was comatose. It can't handle itself autonomously? Oh, yes, but not when there's a general systems failure. So, where did you come to? Pardon me? When you reactivated the cybrid, where was it? Johnny nodded in understanding. He pointed to a boulder less than 5 meters from the Farcaster. Lying there. On this side or the other side? The other side. I went over and examined the spot. No blood, no notes, no murder weapons left lying about. Not even a footprint or indication that Johnny's body had lain there for that eternity of a minute. A police forensics team might have read volumes into the microscopic and biotic clues left there, but all I could see was hard rock. If your memory's really gone, I said, how do you know someone else came here with you? I accessed the Farcaster records. Did you bother to check the mystery person or person's name on the universal card charge? We both Farcast on my card, said Johnny. Just one other person? Yes. I nodded. Farcaster records would solve every interworld crime if the portals were true teleportation. The transport data record could have recreated the subject down to the last gram and follicle. Instead, a Farcaster essentially is just a crude hole ripped in space-time by a phased singularity. If the Farcaster criminal doesn't use his or her own card, the only data we get are origination and destination. Where'd you two Farcast from? I asked. Tau Ceti Center. You have the portal code? Of course. Let's go there and finish this conversation, I said. This place stinks to high heaven. TC Squared, the age-old nickname for Tau Ceti Center, is certainly the most crowded world in the web. Besides its population of 5 billion people scrabbling for room on less than half the land area of Old Earth, it has an orbital ring ecology that is home for 500 million more. In addition to being the capital of the hegemony and home of the Senate, TC Squared is the business nexus for web trade. Naturally, the portal number Johnny had found brought us to a 600 portal terminex in one of the biggest spires in New London, one of the oldest and largest city sections. Hell, I said, let's get a drink. There was a choice of bars near the terminex, and I picked one that was relatively quiet, a simulated ship's tavern, dark, cool, with plenty of fake wood and brass. I ordered a beer. I never drink the hard stuff or use flashback when on a case. Sometimes I think that need for self-discipline is what keeps me in the business. Johnny also ordered a beer, a dark German brew bottled on Renaissance Vector. I found myself wondering what vices a cybrid might have. I said, "What else did you find out before coming to see me?" The young man opened his hands. "Nothing." "Shit," I said reverently. "This is a joke. With all the powers of an AI at your disposal, you can't trace your cybrid's whereabouts and actions for a few days prior to your accident?" "No." Johnny sipped his beer. "Rather, I could, but there are important reasons why I do not want my fellow AIs to find me investigating." "You suspect one of them?" Instead of answering, Johnny handed me a flimsy of his universal card purchases. The blackout caused by my murder left 5 standard days unaccounted for. Here are the card charges for that time. "I thought you said you were only disconnected for a minute." Johnny scratched his cheek with one finger. "I was lucky to lose only 5 days' worth of data," he said. I waved over the human waiter and ordered another beer. "Look," I said, "Johnny, whoever you are, I'll never be able to get an angle on this case unless I know more about you and your situation. Why would someone want to kill you if they know you'll be reconstituted, or whatever the hell it is?" "I see 2 possible motives, said Johnny over his beer. I nodded. "One would be to create just the memory loss they succeeded in getting," I said. "That would suggest that whatever it was they wanted you to forget, it had occurred or come to your attention in the past week or so. What's the second motive?" "To send me a message," said Johnny. "I just don't know what it is or from who." "Do you know who would want to kill you?" "No." "No guesses at all?" "None." "Most murders," I said, "are acts of sudden, mindless rage committed by someone the victim knows well, family, a friend or lover. A majority of the premeditated ones are usually carried out by someone close to the victim." Johnny said nothing. There was something about his face that I found incredibly attractive, a sort of masculine strength combined with a feminine sense of awareness. Perhaps it was the eyes. "Do AIs have families?" I asked. "Feuds? Squabbles? Lover spats?" "No." He smiled slightly. "There are quasi-family arrangements, but they share none of the requirements of emotion or responsibility that human families exhibit. AI families are primarily convenient code groups for showing where certain processing trends originated." "So you don't think another AI attacked you?"
"It's possible."
Johnny rotated his glass in his hands.
"I just do not see why they would attack me through my cybrid."
"Easier access?"
"Perhaps, but it complicates things for the assailant. An attack in Datum Plane would have been infinitely more lethal. Also, I do fail to see any motive for another AI. It makes no sense. I'm a threat to no one."
"Why do you have a cyber, Johnny? Maybe if I understand your role in things, I could get at a motive." He picked up a pretzel and played with it.
"I have a cybrid. In some ways, I am a cybrid because my function is to observe and react to human beings In a sense, I was human once myself. I frowned and shook my head. So far, nothing he'd said had made sense. You've heard of personality retrieval projects? He asked. No. A standard year ago, when the Four Sims recreated the personality of General Horace Glennon Hite to see what made him such a brilliant general, it was in all the news. Yeah? Well, I am, or was, an earlier and much more complicated retrieval project. My core persona was based on a pre-Hegira Old Earth poet. Ancient. Born late 18th century, old calendar. How the hell can they reconstruct a personality that lost in time? Writings, said Johnny. His letters, diaries, critical biographies, testimony of friends, but mostly through his verse. The sim recreates the environment, plugs in the known factors, and works backward from the creative products. Voila, a persona core. Crude at first, but by the time I came into being, relatively refined. Our first attempt was a 20th century poet named Ezra Pound. Our persona was opinionated to the point of absurdity, prejudiced beyond rationality, and functionally insane. It took a year of tinkering before we discovered that the persona was accurate. It was the man who had been nuts. A genius, but nuts. And then what? I said. They build your personality around a dead poet. Then what? This becomes the template upon which the AI is grown, said Johnny. The cybrid allows me to carry out my role in the datum plane community. As poet? Johnny smiled again. More as poem, he said. A poem? An ongoing work of art, but not in the human sense. A puzzle, perhaps. A variable enigma which occasionally offers unusual insights into more serious lines of analysis. I don't get it, I said. It probably does not matter. I very much doubt if my purpose was the cause of the assault. What do you think was the cause? I have no idea. I felt us closing a circle. All right, I said. I'll try to find out what you were doing and who you were with during these lost 5 days. Is there anything besides the credit flimsy that you can think of to help? Johnny shook his head. You know, of course, why it is important for me to know the identity and motive of my assailant? Sure, I said. They might try it again. Precisely. How can I get hold of you if I need to? Johnny passed me an access chip. A secure line? I said. Very. Okay, I said. I'll get back to you if and when I get some information. We moved out of the bar and toward the Terminex. He was moving away when I took 3 quick steps and grabbed his arm. It was the first time that I had touched him. Johnny, what's the name of the Old Earth poet they resurrected? Retrieved. Whatever. The one they built your AI persona on. The attractive cybrid hesitated. I noticed that his eyelashes were very long. How can it be important? He asked. Who knows what's important? He nodded. Keats, he said. Born in A.D. 1795, died of tuberculosis in 1821. John Keats. Following someone through a series of Farcaster changes is damn near impossible, especially if you want to remain undetected. The web cops can do it, given about 50 agents assigned to the task, plus some exotic and damned expensive high-tech toys, not to mention the cooperation of the Transit Authority. For a solo, the task is almost impossible. Still, it was fairly important for me to see where my new client was headed. Johnny did not look back as he crossed the Terminex Plaza. I moved to a nearby kiosk and watched through my pocket-sized imager as he punched codes on a manual disk key, inserted his card, and stepped through the glowing rectangle. The use of the manual disk key probably meant that he was headed for a general access portal, since private caster codes are usually imprinted on eyes-only chips. Great. I'd narrowed his destination down to approximately 2 million portals on 150-some web worlds and half that many moons. With one hand, I pulled the red lining out of my overcoat while I hit replay on the imager, watching through the eyepiece as it magnified the disk key sequence. I tugged out a red cap to go with my new red jacket and pulled the brim low over my face. Moving quickly across the plaza, I queried my comm log about the 9-digit transfer code I'd seen on the imager. I knew the first 3 digits meant the world of Tsingtao Sishuangpana. I'd memorized all the planetary prefixes, and was told an instant later that the portal code led to a residential district in the first expansion city of Wanxin. I hurried to the first open booth and cast there, stepping out onto a small Terminex plaza paved in worn brick. Ancient oriental shops leaned against one another, eaves of their pagoda roofs hanging over narrow side streets. People thronged the plaza and stood in doorways, and while most of those in sight were obviously descendants of the long-flight exiles who settled THP, many were off-worlders. The air smelled of alien vegetation, sewage, and cooking rice. "Damn," I whispered. There were 3 other Farcaster portals there, and none were in constant use. Johnny could have Farcast out immediately. Instead of casting back to Lussis, I spent a few minutes checking the plaza and side streets. By this time, the melanin pill I'd swallowed had worked, and I was a young black woman, or man, it was hard to tell in my trendy red balloon jacket and polarized visor, strolling idly while taking pictures with my tourist imager. The trace pellet I'd dissolved in Johnny's second German beer had had more than enough time to work. The UV-positive microspores were almost hanging in the air by now. I could almost follow the trail of exhalations he had left. Instead, I found a bright yellow handprint on a dark wall, bright yellow to my especially fitted visor, of course, invisible out of the UV spectrum, and then followed the trail of vague blotches where saturated clothing had touched market stalls or stone. Johnny was eating in a Cantonese restaurant less than 2 blocks from the Terminex Plaza. The frying food smelled delicious, but I restrained myself from entering, checking prices in alley bookstalls and haggling in the market for almost an hour before he finished, returned to the plaza and Farcast out. This time he used a chip code, a private portal certainly, possibly a private home, and I took 2 chances by using my pilotfish card to follow him. 2 chances because, first, the card is totally illegal and would someday cost me my license if caught, less than likely if I kept using Daddy Silva's obscenely expensive but aesthetically perfect shape-changer chips. And second, I ran a better-than-even chance of ending up in the living room of Johnny's house, never an easy situation to talk one's way out of. It was not his living room. Even before I'd located the street signs, I recognized the familiar extra tug of gravity, the dim bronze light, the scent of oil and ozone in the air, and knew I was home on Lussis.
Johnny had cast into a medium-security private residential tower in one of the Bergson hives. Perhaps that was why he'd chosen my agency. We were almost neighbors, less than 600 clicks apart. My cybrid was not in sight. I walked purposefully so as not to alert any security vids programmed to respond to loitering. There was no residence directory, no numbers or names on the apartment doorways, and no listings accessible by comlog. I guessed that there were about 20,000 residential cubbies in East Bergson Hive. The telltales were fading as the spore soup died, but I checked only two of the radial corridors before I found a trail. Johnny lived far out on a glass-floored wing about a methane lake. His palm lock showed a faintly glowing handprint. I used my cat burglar tools to take a reading of the lock, and then I cast home. All in all, I'd watched my man go out for Chinese food and then go home for the night. Enough accomplished for one day. B.B. Serbringer was my AI expert. B.B. worked in hegemony flow control records and statistics and spent most of his life reclining on a free-fall couch with half a dozen microleads running from his skull while he communed with other bureaucrats in Datum Plain. I'd known him in college when he was a pure cyberpuke, a 20th-generation hacker, cortically shunted when he was 12 standard. His real name was Ernest, but he'd earned the nickname BB when he went out with a friend of mine named Shayla Toyo. Shayla'd seen him naked on their second date and had laughed for a solid half hour. Ernest was, and is, almost 2 meters tall, but masses less than 50 kilos. Shayla said that he had a butt like two BBs and, like most cruel things do, the nickname stuck. I visited him in one of the windowless worker monoliths on TC Squared. No cloud towers for BB and his ilk. "So, Brawn," he said, "how come you're getting information literate in your old age? You're too old to get a real job." "I just want to know about AIs, BB." "Only one of the most complex topics in the known universe." He sighed and looked longingly at his disconnected neural shunt and metacortex leads. Cyberpukes never come down, but civil servants are required to dismount for lunch. BB was like most cyberpukes in that he never felt comfortable exchanging information when he wasn't riding a data wave. "So what do you want to know?" he said. "Why did the AIs drop out?" I had to start somewhere. BB made a convoluted gesture with his hands. "They said they had projects which were not compatible with total immersion in hegemony, read human affairs. Truth is, nobody knows."
"But they're still around, still managing things?"
"Sure, the system couldn't run without them. You know that, Brawn. Even the All thing couldn't work without AI management of the real-time Schwarzschild patterning."
"Okay," I said, cutting him off before he lapsed into cyberpukies. "But what are their other projects?"
"No one knows. Branner and Swayze up at Art Intel Core think that the AIs are pursuing the evolution of consciousness on a galactic scale. We know they have their own probes out, far deeper into the outback than..."
"What about cybrids?"
"Cybrids?"
BB sat up and looked interested for the first time.
"Why do you mention cybrids?"
"Why are you surprised that I mentioned them, BB?" He absently rubbed his shunt socket.
"Well, first of all, most people forget they exist. 2 centuries ago, it was all alarmism and pod people taking over and all that, but now nobody thinks about them. Also, I just ran across an anomaly advisory yesterday that said that cybrids were disappearing."
"Disappearing?" It was my turn to sit up.
"You know, being phased out. The AIs used to maintain about 1,000 licensed cybrids in the web, about half of them based right here on TC Squared. Last week's census showed about 2/3 of those had been recalled in the past month or so."
What happens when an AI recalls its hybrid?
I don't know. They're destroyed, I suppose. AIs don't like to waste things, so I imagine the genetic material's recycled somehow.
Why are they being recycled?
Nobody knows, Braun. But then most of us don't know why the AIs do most of the things they do.
Do experts see them, the AIs, as a threat?
Are you kidding? 600 years ago, maybe. 2 centuries ago, the secession made us leery. But if the things wanted to hurt humanity, they could have done it long before this. Worrying about AIs turning on us is about as productive as worrying that farm animals are going to revolt.
Except the AIs are smarter than we, I said.
Yeah, well, there is that.
Bibi, have you heard of personality retrieval projects?
Like the Glennon Height thing? Sure, everyone has. I even worked on one at Rijks University a few years ago, but they're passé. No one's doing them anymore.
Why's that?
Jesus, you don't know shit about anything, do you, Braun? The personality retrieval projects were all washouts. Even with the best SIM control, they got the Force OCS-HTN network involved. You can't factor all variables successfully. The persona template becomes self-aware. I don't mean just self-aware like you and me, but self-aware that it's an artificially self-aware persona, and that leads to terminal strange loops and non-harmonic labyrinths that go straight to Escher space.
Translate, I said. Bibi sighed and glanced at the blue and gold time band on the wall. 5 minutes and his mandatory lunch hour was over. He could rejoin the real world.
Translated, he said. The retrieved personality breaks down, goes crazy, psycho city, bugfuck.
All of them?
All of them.
But the AIs are still interested in the process?
Oh yeah? Who says? They've never done one. All the retrieval efforts I've ever heard of were human-run, mostly botched university projects. Brain-dead academics spending fortunes to bring back dead academic brains.
I forced a smile. There were 3 minutes until he could plug back in. Were all the retrieved personalities given hybrid remotes?
Uh-uh. What gave you that idea, Braun? None were. Couldn't work.
Why not?
It'd just fuck up the StimSim. Plus, you'd need perfect clone stock and an interactive environment precise to the last detail. You see, kiddo, with a retrieved personality, you let it live in its world via full-scale sim, and then you just sneaked a few questions in via dreams or scenario interactives, pulling a persona out of sim reality into slow time.
This was the Cyberpuke's age-old term for the, pardon the expression, real world.
Would just drive it bugfuck all the sooner,
he finished. I shook my head. Yeah, well, thanks, Bibi. I moved to the door. There were 30 seconds left before my old college friend could escape from slow time. Bibi, I said as an afterthought, have you ever heard of a persona retrieved from an old Earth poet named John Keats?
Keats? Oh, sure. There was a big write-up on that in my undergrad text. Marty Carolus did that about 50 years ago at New Cambridge.
What happened?
The usual. Persona went strange loop. But before it broke up, it died a full sim death. Some ancient disease.
Bibi glanced at the clock, smiled, and lifted his shunt. Before clicking it into his skull socket, he looked at me again, almost beatifically.
I remember now, he said through his dreamy smile. It was tuberculosis.
If our society ever opted for Orwell's Big Brother approach, the instrument of choice for oppression would have to be the credit wake. In a totally non-cash economy, with only a vestigial barter black market, a person's activities could be tracked in real time by monitoring the credit wake of his or her universal card. There were strict laws protecting card privacy, but laws had a bad habit of being ignored or abrogated when societal push came to totalitarian shove. Johnny's credit wake for the 5-day period leading to his murder showed a man of regular habits and modest expenses. Before following up the leads on the credit flimsy, I'd spent a dull 2 days following Johnny himself. Data. He lived alone in East Berksenhive. A routine check showed that he'd lived there about 7 local months, less than 5 standard. In the morning, he had breakfast at a local cafe and then farcast to Renaissance Vector, where he worked for about 5 hours, evidently gathering research of some sort in the print archives, followed by a light lunch at a courtyard vendor stand, another hour or two in the library, and then cast home to Lussis or to some favorite eating spot on another world. In his cubby by 2200 hours. More farcasting than the average Lussian middle-class drone, but an otherwise uninspiring schedule. The credit flimsies confirmed that he had held to the agenda on the week he was murdered, with the addition of a few extra purchases, shoes one day, groceries the next, and one stop at a bar on Renaissance V on the day of his murder. I joined him for dinner at the small restaurant on Red Dragon Street near the Tsingtao Cishuangpana portal. The food was very hot, very spicy, and very good. "How is it going?" he asked. "Great. I'm 1,000 marks richer than when we met, and I found a good Cantonese restaurant." "I'm glad my money is going toward something important." "Speaking of your money, where does it come from? Hanging out in a Renaissance Vector library can't pay much." Johnny raised an eyebrow. "I live on a small inheritance." "Not too small, I hope. I want to be paid."
"It will be adequate for our purposes, Emlemia. Have you discovered anything of interest?" I shrugged.
"Tell me what you do in that library."
"Can it possibly be germane?"
"Yeah, could be."
He looked at me strangely. Something about his eyes made me go weak at the knees.
"You remind me of someone," he said softly.
"Oh?"
From anyone else, that line would have been cause for an exit.
"Who?"
I asked.
"A woman I once knew, long ago."
He brushed fingers across his brow as if he were suddenly tired or dizzy.
"What was her name?"
"Fanny." The word was almost whispered. I knew who he was talking about. John Keats had a fiance named Fanny. Their love affair had been a series of romantic frustrations which almost drove the poet mad. When he died in Italy, alone except for one fellow traveler, feeling abandoned by friends and his lover, Keats had asked that unopened letters from Fanny and a lock of her hair be buried with him. I'd never heard of John Keats before this week. I'd accessed all this shit with my comm log. I said, "So what do you do at the library?" The cybrid cleared his throat.
"I'm researching a poem, searching for fragments of the original."
"Something by Keats?"
"Yes."
"Wouldn't it be easier to access it?"
"Of course, but it is important for me to see the original, to touch it."
I thought about that. "What's the poem about?" He smiled, or at least his lips did. The hazel eyes still seemed troubled.
"It's called Hyperion. It's difficult to describe what it's about. Artistic failure, I suppose. Keats never finished it."
I pushed aside my plate and sipped warm tea. You say Keats never finished it. Don't you mean you never finished it? His look of shock had to be genuine, unless AIs were consummate actors. For all I knew, they could be. Good God, he said. I'm not John Keats. Having a persona based upon a retrieval template no more makes me Keats than having the name Lamia makes you a monster. There have been a million influences that have separated me from that poor, sad genius. You said I reminded you of Fanny. An echo of a dream. Less. You've taken RNA learning medication, yes? Yes. It's like that. Memories which feel hollow. A human waiter brought fortune cookies. Do you have any interest in visiting the real Hyperion? I asked. What's that? The outback world. Somewhere beyond Parvati, I think. Johnny looked puzzled. He had broken open the cookie, but had not yet read the fortune. It used to be called Poet's World, I think, I said. It even has a city named after you, after Keats. The young man shook his head. I'm sorry, I haven't heard of the place. How can that be? Don't AIs know everything? His laugh was short and sharp. This one knows very little. He read his fortune. Be wary of sudden impulses. I crossed my arms. You know, except for that parlor trick with the bank manager Hollow, I have no proof that you are what you say you are. Give me your hand. My hand? Yes, either one. Thank you. Johnny held my right hand in both of his. His fingers were longer than mine. Mine were stronger. Close your eyes, he said. I did. There was no transition. One instant I was sitting in the Blue Lotus on Red Dragon Street, and the next I was nowhere, somewhere, streaking through gray-blue datum plain, banking along chrome-yellow information highways, passing over and under and through great cities of glowing information storage, red skyscrapers sheathed in black security ice. Simple entities like personal accounts or corporate files blazing like burning refineries in the night. Above it all, just out of sight, as if poised in twisted space, hung the gigantic weights of the AIs, their simplest communications pulsing like violent heat lightning along the infinite horizons. Somewhere in the distance, all but lost in the maze of three-dimensional neon that partitioned one tiny second of arc in the incredible datasphere of one small world, I sensed rather than saw those soft hazel eyes waiting for me. Johnny released my hand. He cracked my fortune cookie open. The strip of paper read, "Invest wisely in new ventures." Jesus, I whispered. Bibi had taken me flying in datum plane before, but without a shunt, the experience had been a shadow of this. It was the difference between watching a black and white hollow of a fireworks display and being there. How do you do that? Will you be making any progress on the case tomorrow? He asked. I regained my composure. Tomorrow, I said, I plan to solve it. Well, maybe not solve it, but at least get things moving. The last charge on Johnny's credit flimsy had been the bar on Renaissance V. I'd checked it out the first day, of course, talked to several of the regulars since there was no human bartender, but had come up with no one who remembered.